Is he on with the, okay. Okay, Jim, we're ready to roll. If you want to get him going, I'll give you about 15 seconds of nothing here while you got them both rolling. Okay, I'll go in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Our guest today is one of the best-known figures in the United States manned space exploration program, Christopher C. Kraft, Director of Flight Operations for all of this country's manned space flights from the beginning of Project Mercury through today's Apollo journeys to the moon. Chris Kraft, or Dr. Kraft, since he's received two honorary doctorates during his eventful career, is a familiar name, as familiar as the names of the astronauts who've gone into space. He and his associates have been the men who man Mission Control, who guide and direct the progress of manned flights after they lift into the sky. It is the development of techniques and procedures in Mission Control which have made possible the precise, on-the-second maneuvers necessary to guide spacecraft to a pinpoint landing on the moon, some 380,000 kilometers distant, and then landing on Earth beside waiting rescue forces. Chris Kraft has been honored for his work as Director of Manned Flight Operations by being named on several occasions as one of the outstanding young men in America. He's a native of Virginia, was educated as an aeronautical engineer at Virginia Polytechnic Institute, and was a member of the 1958 Space Task Group at Langley Research Center, the organization which developed manned space flight in this country. You've certainly heard his voice before, and we again welcome Dr. Chris Kraft to Press Conference USA.
Thank you. Very nice to be here again.
Now may I ask our news correspondents to identify themselves.
Robert Cowan, Christian Science Monitor.
Louis Desroches, Agence France-Presse.
Arthur Hill, Houston Chronicle.
For our first question to Mr. Kraft, let's turn to you, Mr. Cowan.
Mr. Kraft, we were all excited and impressed by that pinpoint landing practically on top of the Surveyor. What does this say about our capability for future missions, and what kind of missions are you looking toward now?
Well, I think it gives us a great deal of confidence that some of the techniques that we have for updating this spacecraft navigational system, its guidance and navigation, is reasonable, and that we can expect to land fairly close to some particular point on the lunar surface. Now, that very fact was a necessary element to the planning of the future Apollo landings on the moon. Most of the places that we're interested in going to in the future, with the exception of one or two, require the spacecraft to land within something like a 1 kilometer circle, a diameter circle. Now, the success we had, I hope, implies to us that we can utilize that technique in the future. I think there is still some doubt in a technical sense in our minds as to the difficulty of landing at a particular point, and until we've had a chance to really debrief the crew of Apollo 12, I don't think we're willing to commit to that type of program as yet. I think it intuitively, I think we can, but I don't think that we have the all of the facts gathered yet that will allow us to go to some of the places that the scientists are interested in going to.
These are mountains. Do you think you'll get into the mountains sometime?
Well, when you look at the places the scientists want to go, they want to go into craters, they want to go around craters, they want to go in the highlands areas where there are mountains, all the various anomalistic areas of the moon which the geologists and the geophysicists are interested in. And certainly I don't think you can pick out any type of terrain that at the end of the Apollo program, assuming we can do it, that we will not have been to on the moon.
Mr. Desroches.
With a successful pinpoint landing in particular, with a longer traverse on the moon and more scientific equipment left there, Apollo 12 seems to be a long step forward as compared with Apollo 11, both from an engineering and a scientific point of view. Would you care, Dr. Kraft, to elaborate on this opinion?
Well, I guess I have to look at that two different ways, Louis. Certainly, I think the accomplishments of Apollo 11 were the culmination of a tremendous technological step by the United States, and therefore I looked at that as a tremendous undertaking and therefore a tremendous accomplishment. We set out to land on the moon in this decade, and that was the answer to that commitment. So I think that was a fantastic accomplishment in itself. Now, when you talk about specifics of comparing the amount of science that we obtained on Apollo 11 as opposed to the amount of science we obtained on Apollo 12, then I must agree with you that we accomplished a great deal more from that point of view. Certainly, the amount of work that Conrad and Bean were able to do in strictly in the and totally in the name of science on the moon was terrific. We're very pleased with it. I'm sure the scientists are pleased with it, and I think it probably gives them a real feel for the amount of work that can be done in the future in each one of these missions, and will give us an opportunity to probably better plan it as a result of the work on Apollo 12.
Mr. Hill.
Well, Chris, do you think that because of the success of Apollo 12 that perhaps in the near future, in a closer time than maybe we might have thought possible a few days ago, that scientists, that is, specialists, will also be included on these flights in addition to the pilot astronauts? And what about foreign astronauts? Any possibility of those coming along?
Well, let me answer that question two ways. First, I believe that, yes, scientists are going to go to the lunar surface. And now, when that will be is really dependent upon the training cycle. Most of the scientists, however, that we have in the program at this time are not geologists. We only have one geologist in the program at this point in time, and I'm sure he's going to go to the moon. I can't predict precisely what flight it will be. But I want to emphasize that training aspect of this mission. We've got to assure ourselves that we are not jeopardizing the safety of the mission, and we will assure ourselves before we commit to that scientist being a part of the operation. I think it can be done, and I don't mean to imply that that's an insurmountable task, and I think very shortly that we will come to that conclusion and make public announcement of same. On the other hand, you said about foreign astronauts. Again, I think that that's probably beyond the Apollo program. I think certainly as we progress into the space station era where we are transporting people in space shuttles, I think it probably doesn't even require astronauts per se. I think at that point in time, both engineers and scientists without any training whatsoever with regard to their ability as an astronaut will be passengers in these flights after we've gone through the research and development phase of those missions. And so I see all kinds of people going into space in the next 10 years which are not related to astronauts even.
What would be the limitations there? Just physical capacity to endure space?
Just the assurance that we're not going to have somebody with some physical defect occur during the operation. I think that the types of accelerations, the types of environment that we're going to put these people in are not very demanding on the body functions, and I think it will just require some association with the environment they're going to have to live in, and I don't think that'll require a great deal of training, nowhere near the training that is presently required for our astronauts today.
Mr. Cowan.
Well, Mr. Kraft, may I apply for one of those flights right now?
Well, indeed you might, and you will be in line after me because I want to go also.
Well, I think you've earned that privilege. When we do have that space lab up there and those shuttles, will you need the elaborate ground control that you now have here?
To some extent, I think the answer is yes, but I think it will take on a different flavor, if you will. I don't think that it will be so much involved with the safety aspect of the mission as it will be with the data gathering of the mission and the formulation of plans to do certain experiments and to utilize the network facilities we have on the ground and the satellite communications and also the scheduling of events that take place in the spacecraft. So I think it is going to take a rather elaborate system to do that sort of thing. It'll just shift its emphasis. Getting things up into space is never going to be so easy or so that we won't be worried about the efficiency of the use of our time. And scheduling then of things, when you can look at certain stars, when you can look in the sun, when you can look at certain parts of the Earth, doing the Earth resources, when you are planning to do experiments, what accelerations you have at various points in the spacecraft, whether it's going to be in a vacuum or in 5 psi or 10 psi, all of those things will have to be laid out in a schedule, and that's going to take a lot of doing.
Mr. DeRoche?
Well, before some of us get on board some space shuttles, Chris, what do you think of the possible duration of future extravehicular activities on the moon? Can they be extended? Will they? Or are you in favor, rather, to stick to a four-hour duration and have one more walk, for instance, on the moon than Apollo 12 did?
Well, we now have two data points, one from Apollo 11, one from Apollo 12, as to the length of time that crewmen have spent on the surface, and I think that implications are that you can probably spend a little bit more time on the lunar surface than the Apollo 12 crew did. They were up to about 4 hours. We can probably stay out about 5 hours without too much difficulty on the part of the crew's body functions and the need for water and food. It appears that the primary life support system that we have in the present Apollo program has about a 6-hour capability. We designed it to have a 3.5-hour capability, but the conservatism in that design, which is fantastic design in my opinion, is probably going to allow us to have about a 6-hour capability, and that appears to be very reasonable in the types of EVAs that we're planning. I would like to point out, however, that one of the problems that we face in the planning of the EVAs is the distance that you will allow the crew to part from the lunar module, or the safety of the lunar module, if you will, because you are now dependent on one primary life support system with a oxygen purge system which only has a 30-minute capability. And so we're limited in the traverse that we're willing to go away from the limb. We're going to have to come up with some other system which will give us a better backup than the, and a longer length of time.
Mr. DeRoche, you had a follow-up to that.
Yes, speaking with that need for water and food, can anything be done about that on future flights?
You mean that they could actually take water in and eat food while they were on the surface? I seriously doubt it. I think that would take a very drastic redesign of the Apollo suit, and I don't see that in the cards for the immediate future.
Mr. Hill.
Well, in line with the extravehicular activity being lengthened, slightly at least, what about the plans for a vehicle to travel over the lunar surface? How is that going to affect exploration, and what's it going to mean on these later Apollo flights?
Well, as you know, we are in the process of designing a what we call a lunar rover vehicle, a small four-wheel vehicle that the astronauts can ride on. The main purpose of that, however, is to increase the distance that the crew can get away from a particular landing site. And, for instance, in some of the areas, such as Censorinus or Littrow, where it's not too difficult to land in those, by the way, but you want to go to a lot of different areas which, if centralized, require you to go something between 5 and 10 kilometers distance away from the spacecraft. So the point of the rover is to get you to that point as quickly as possible so you can do as much geology as feasible in a surrounding area. So it allows you to cover a lot more distance, but you won't stop in between like you can on a walking traverse. So you're going to have to trade that off.
Well, could you give us some idea of what kind of distances you're talking about with the rover?
Yes, we're talking somewhere between 5 and 15 kilometers, and the rover has a speed of something like 4 to 8 kilometers per hour in those kinds of ranges. The vehicle weighs about 400 pounds and can be carried in one of the bays of the lunar module. Again, though, I want to point out that you've got to trade that payload off against Delta V. So that's one of the things which bothers me to some extent about Apollo 12 anyway, is that Conrad was able to get to about 200 feet altitude over the landing point with about the nominal fuel we expected him to use and the nominal fuel reserves that he would have at that point. From that point down, however, he used a great deal more than we expected. And he was about 1 minute over the average of a nominal manual landing that we run in the simulators and the trainers. Now that's got to be reckoned with. We've got to find out why it took that much longer. I suspect we already know it has to do with the dust and his inability to judge horizontal velocities, his inability to pick up landmarks on the surface at that particular altitude, his reluctance to descend rapidly because he didn't have a real good feel for where he was. And I think that's going to be a real thing, and I think it's got to be reckoned with in the planning of the future missions.
This is one of the things you're most interested in talking with Pete Conrad about, isn't it?
Indeed. And I can't wait to get that information from him, because I think it is very important to our future planning.
Well, he didn't eat too much into his fuel reserve, did he? I mean, you talk about being a minute over. How close was he as far as his reserve was concerned?
Well, let's see. I think we figured that he landed 35 seconds after low level, and you got 100 and...
And that's 500 feet?
No, I'm not sure I know what you mean by the 500 feet.
What do you mean by low level?
The low level light
on
the fuel system comes on, and at a particular point, it tells you have a certain amount of fuel remaining. It's 113 seconds of hover time at 25% thrust. And we figure he landed about 35 seconds after low-level light. So in this particular flight, he had 113 minus 35 seconds left to fly. So you're right, he still had plenty of margin. The point I'm making, however, is that as you begin to add all these various scientific packages and the rover onto the LEM, you've eaten into that payload and eaten into your hover time.
We'll have more questions from Mr. Kraft in just a moment. You're listening to Press Conference USA, a weekly discussion program brought to you by The Voice of America. Today's guest is Christopher Kraft, Director of Flight Operations for United States Manned Space Missions. Today's program is coming to you from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. Questioning Mr. Kraft are Robert Cowan of the Christian Science Monitor, Louis Deroche of Agence France-Presse, and Arthur Hill of the Houston Chronicle. For our next question, Mr. Cowan.
Mr. Kraft, when do you think you can set up a base on the moon so you won't have all this concern about coming and going for every mission?
Well, I think that's a tough question to ask an operator. All I can give you is a guess. And that guess is really a subjective one from the standpoint of what the country wants to do in its space program, how many dollars it's willing to spend, and where it wants it to concentrate its effort. If we decide that exploration of the moon is the proper thing to do with the space dollars, and we wanted to concentrate on doing that and establishing a lunar base, I suspect we could do that by the late 70s or early 80s and come up with a very fine base on the moon where men could spend up to months. I would question in my own mind that that's what we really want to do. But I'm not in a position to have all the facts, nor do I think we will have until we've explored the moon to some extent much greater than we have to determine the real need for going back to the moon.
Mr. Deroche.
Well, since we are speaking of a base on the moon, from what Apollo 11 and 12 have taught us, can the surface of the moon be considered dangerous for men? Has the lunar dust, for instance, created any real problem on the way back to Earth on Apollo 12? And do you think that soon quarantine may safely be dispensed with?
Well, the lunar surface is dangerous to man because of the environment, not because of the surface itself, the environment that surrounds the surface. It is a vacuum, and it has high temperatures and cold temperatures that have got to be reckoned with, and that will always be there, a very hostile environment. The surface, or the lunar dust, the rocks, that sort of thing, I don't think presents any more hazard than going around the Earth. It's just the fact that you have to live in that hostile environment. The dust on Apollo 12 preempting Conrad and Bean. My feeling on the matter, I think it was more a nuisance than a serious problem. And I really believe that by the time they got back to Earth that the lunar dust was probably not a problem in the command module. I suspect it was a very high nuisance when they were in the lunar module, however, because you can imagine that they had great difficulty in cleaning up the lunar module. And then lifting off, under a G-field on the lunar surface, all this stuff is settled to the bottom of the spacecraft, and then getting into orbit where you're now back to zero G, and you have all that lunar dust floating around in the spacecraft, that must have been a very bad nuisance to them, and I think we'll hear probably hear some words about that.
Do you go along with it just being nuisance rather than dangerous?
I think so, yes, because I think we've designed the systems to be able to take that kind of debris and clean it up. It just takes a little time and so forth. Now, you asked about quarantine.
Yes.
Again, that's a mute question because I think there are valid concerns on the part of some of the people on the back contamination committee that as we go to different areas, as we sample lower into the depths of the lunar surface, that we might still uncover some pathogen, and we can't ignore that fact. I suspect, however, that maybe after Apollo 13 that the quarantine may be allowed to at least be somewhat reduced from what it is right now.
Mr. Hill?
Well, Chris, talking about a base on the moon, I'm wondering if you think that there's going to be enough scientifically interesting things on the moon to either warrant a base or warrant extended scientific exploration, or whether there are some other planets in the solar system that that might offer a greater challenge if we were to decide to go to them.
Well, I'm really not qualified to answer that in the first place, because I'm not that kind of a scientist. I'm a scientist in that I'm seeking the unknown, but not the unknown from the lunar surface. I'm not a geologist or a geophysicist. And I think it's really up to them to trade off where the greatest science payload, science activity should be carried out, whether it's on the lunar surface or on Mars, if you have a trade-off to make. Let me say, however, from an engineering point of view, that I believe that the greatest impact of the space program on the country has been as a technology driver, and I want to see that promulgated, because I think that is very important to the country. I think that we have got to keep the technology base going. The space program has been one of the prime drivers in that, and I want to see that continue, and therefore I believe it is important to attack new problems, new ideas, which will drive us in that direction.
May I ask you to just go a step farther? We have heard quite a bit of discussion in the last months, particularly since we finally landed on the moon. The initial goal of Apollo was achieved with the landing. The scientific community, parts of it, becoming more vocal and speaking out more on the expenditure of funds, the scientists versus the engineers. And is there anything else you'd care to elaborate on this particular discussion, which is a healthy one in the United States?
In the first place, the rift between the scientists and the engineers has only been developed by the newspapers and is really not a realistic thing. It does not exist. The discussions we have are bound to lead to differences of opinion as to how things should be done. And some people in their personalities get disgruntled with that, but that's the normal course of human life. In the main, I think that the engineers have been very receptive to the scientists' desires. The scientists have been very receptive to the engineers' problems in carrying them out. And I think that we have arrived in the Apollo program at a very good balance of what the trade-offs between science and the safety of the operation are. I'm very pleased with the science support that we've gotten. I'm happy with the results we've been able to give them, and I think that the program in that regard is well off, and that if we could prevent this newspaper promulgation, again I use that word, of going forth with a rift that does not exist, because an awful lot of the scientists in the country don't understand what is really going on here, and they think that the engineers truly are opposed to science in the program, and we certainly are not. And I hope that the scientists recognize that there's an awful lot of headline writing here that really does not tell the story about what's going on in the program.
Mr. Cowan.
Well, Mr. Kraft, if I could refer to something that was written not by the newspapers, but by the President's Science Advisory Committee. They recently have criticized the space program for not putting enough emphasis on the basic biology of spaceflight. They claim that man is not qualified for long space flights because the program has not developed the kind of basic fundamental biological information you need to understand what's going on. It's merely proved it's safe to send a man to the moon for 10 days and bring it back. Could you comment on that?
Well, again, I'm not qualified to talk about the real medical aspects, the medical operations and research that goes on. I think we are attempting to do that in the Apollo applications program. What we set out to do in Apollo was first prove that we could fly the length of the Apollo mission and not have any bad effects on man, and we did that. That was our major objective. It is true that we did not set out to go into any kind of medical research in the program. We are attempting to do that in the AAP program, and I think that Dr. Berry, for instance, would be much better qualified to tell you there what the details of that program are. If there is criticism that exists there, I think that you have to recognize again that we were setting out to land on the moon in this decade, and that was foremost in our minds at that time.
Mr. DeRoche.
Now that we are speaking of long-duration space flights, do you think, Chris, that a manned landing on Mars can be achieved by 1981 or 82? But first, could you give us some general idea on the flight profile, and then tell us if it seems advisable to fly in that direction early in the next decade or at a later date, like before the end of the century?
Well, first, yes, I do believe we could fly to Mars by 1981 and 82 if that were the only objective of the space program. And I think that you see from the recommendations to this present scientific advisory group that that was not the recommendation, that we ought to have a balanced space program. Frankly, I believe in that. The flight plan, I think, Louis, is longer than I could explain in the time we have left for this program.
Mr. Hill.
Well, if you can go to Mars sometime in the next, 20, 30 years, do you think the kinds of rockets that we have now are going to be applicable to that, or will you need something different?
Oh, I think we need something grossly different than what we have today. I think we need nuclear stages and newly developed engines and that sort of thing. I think it requires a whole new technology. I think the Saturn V might provide the base for getting into lunar orbit with heavy payloads from where you would have a space base to go to the planets. But the hardware necessary to go to Mars is a whole new set of developments, which I think you'll see us develop over the next 10 years.
Mars is a long way, isn't it?
Indeed it is.
Mr. Cowan.
Mr. Kraft, your former boss once said that an astronaut would stand on Ganymede, a moon of Jupiter, in this century. Do you think he's right?
I hope he's right, because I think that that's the proper kind of challenge over the next 30 or 40 years. And we need those kinds of challenges to keep the technology of the country going. I can't emphasize that fact too much. I feel very strongly about it.
Gentlemen, we have about another half minute. Does anybody have a last question for Mr. Kraft? Mr. DeRoche?
What went wrong with the TV camera on the moon, Chris?
Well, I think they pointed it at the sun, and that burned the iris or whatever the technicians call that. And I think in the future we'll make sure that we put some covers on it and possibly carry two cameras.
Gentlemen, I see our time is up. Thank you very much, Chris Kraft, Director of Flight Operations, for being with us today. And thank you, gentlemen of the press, for being with us on Press Conference USA. This is Rhett Turner in Houston. 2820, if you're timing that back there, Jim, or up there on the line. That's what it takes across the internet.